God does not exist. He's supposedly all good. He's supposedly all powerful, so he would be able to and he would want to stop evil. But there's evil in the world. So God does not exist. At least that's how the argument goes. Whether it's compelling or not, whether it's logically sound, that's a whole nother question. And so this is what we call the problem of evil, or evil and suffering. If God is all good and if God is all powerful, then evil should not exist. But evil does exist, so God does not exist, people would say. Throughout history, this has had the proper name of being called theodicy. And this is not just troubling to Christians, or to non-Christians, sorry, but to Christians as well. Non-Christians like to complain about the evil in the world. But Christians, we're experiencing evil too. We all know someone, or maybe we ourselves have experienced some evil deed done to us. And the question comes, well, if God is all good, and if God is all powerful, why did that thing happen? And so it's important for us to understand how to deal with this issue, not just for those outside of the church that we witness to, but for ourselves, for those of us in the church. Because on the face of it, this problem of evil seems to point to God not existing, or maybe not being good, or not being powerful. But this isn't just a problem for Christians or non-Christians. It's a problem for every single person. Every worldview must have an answer for this problem of evil. And so the real question is which worldview has the best answer? Which worldview makes the most sense of evil? Now, when we talk about evil and suffering, there's a lot that falls under that. I probably don't need to enumerate those things for you. But think of murder, of rape, of genocide. These are things that pretty much everyone, without exception, agrees are wrong. The destruction of the Canaanites. If you've read your Old Testament, this was a people group that God ordered the total destruction of. And atheists and others would complain that this makes God immoral. Look, he committed genocide. That's an evil. That's the type of stuff we're talking about tonight. But I'm here to tell you this is not a good argument. The problem of evil, it's not a good argument. Even if it's true, which it's not, and I'll show you why, it still wouldn't prove that God doesn't exist. It would only possibly prove that maybe he's not as all-powerful as we thought. He could still be totally good. And it logically is a possibility that God is not totally good, but is all-powerful. Those are logical possibilities. And so even if the atheist wants to use this argument and finds it compelling, they still have to deal with where everything came from. And that gets to the cosmological argument that we talked about 1 or 2 weeks ago. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore, the universe has a cause. They still have to account for that. There's no getting away from it. But actually, the problem of evil, it's not a problem for God. There's no logical contradiction in any of the following statements. God is all good. God is all powerful. God created the world, and the world contains evil. There is no logical problem there. What atheists and people who use this argument really mean, however, is God is all good, God is all powerful, God created the world. They sneak this next line in there, but never say it. The world shouldn't contain evil. That's an assumption. That's not something, that's something they bring their values to. Now they're saying, my moral view says the world should not contain evil. But notice there's no contradiction in those other statements. And that's really important to understand. Atheists like to call themselves the reasonable ones, the logical ones. They have reason rallies. And so, when talking with them, let's go heavy on the reason and the logic and show that there's no logical incompatibility in God being all-powerful, all-good, and there being evil in the world. And we'll talk about where that evil comes from. But what people do is they assume that God must want to eliminate all evil. That's an assumption. But in order to know that there's actual evil in the world that doesn't serve a good purpose, you'd have to be omniscient. You'd have to be God. And none of us are God. Some people might like to think that, but when it comes to the end of the day, everyone knows they don't know everything. You're not omniscient. And so you can't know that there isn't evil that happens that doesn't serve a legitimate purpose. A sister question and a problem with the problem of evil is the question, why is there so much evil? This actually sometimes is more popular. Well, some questions you could ask. So much evil compared to what? How much evil is the right amount of evil for you? 5 units? 10 units? No, not 20 units. That's too much. Let's back it off a little. Now, see, this question, it makes no sense when you actually try and apply it. How much evil is enough for you? I've never heard a good answer to that. Another question. How do you know that God hasn't reduced the amount of evil to just what is necessary for the greatest amount of good? We don't know that. We have no way to know that. And neither does the person making the accusation against God. You would have to, once again, be omniscient. Christian apologist Frank Turk likes to say, if God stopped evil, he might start with you. I don't know how helpful that is in a conversation, but it is quite comical. But I think it illustrates something that you could actually use in a conversation. Most people are all too concerned with pointing out the evil out there. What about the evil they do? What about the person who brings up the problem of evil? Statistically, there's a really good chance that they've stolen from the place they work, or they've had an affair, or they've lied, or they've treated their kids poorly. But everyone's so comfortable complaining about the evil out there. What about the evil that we do? And so sometimes when Christians want to say all the evil out there, once again, what about the evil that I do in my personal life? That doesn't in any way diminish what is out there, but it puts it in perspective. Importantly, Christianity doesn't teach that there shouldn't be evil in the world. Christianity predicts evil and our societal state. It describes how evil came to be. And more helpfully, it provides a solution. People have this idea of God. He's just sitting up there and all this evil is happening and he doesn't do anything. Well, that's not true. God got down here in the fray of it, was the bearer and experiencer of evil done to him, one who deserved none of it, the only one who deserved none of it. And also, he could provide a way for us out. So God got in the fray. He got involved. He is not just some passive observer. And so there is no logical problem with the problem of evil. What we must say is that God has a good reason for allowing evil and suffering. That's not a cop-out, but it is a claim that I'm not omniscient. I don't know how it all works together, and I can't. But Scripture teaches in Romans 8:28 that we know that all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. The sentence doesn't end there. Because those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son. It actually doesn't end there either, but that is a more complete thought. For the Christian, all things are working together, not for my physical good, not for my worldly good, for my spiritual good, for me to be conformed to the image of Christ. That's what this verse that we quote all the time means. And we look at Paul. Paul had a much more rough life than we did, but he was being conformed more to the image of Christ than a lot of us, or at least myself. And we see him sitting in prison, not complaining, but praising God. Conformity to Christ in all things working together. So here's what the Bible says about how evil came into the world. God created the world, and it was good. Satan rebelled, man sinned, and his nature was corrupted. And yet, through all of this, God is ultimately the authority. He's ultimately in control. So, $1 million question, why is there murder, rape, abortion, genocide? Why is there pain and suffering? Here's the profound answer. Because people choose to commit those acts. I know that's kind of a letdown, but that's the answer. It comes down to free will. Now, I know this is not emotionally compelling. This doesn't make us feel better when someone does something wrong to us. God, why is there this evil? Well, someone actually did it. However, the problem of evil that I started out saying, God is all good, God is all powerful, evil shouldn't exist, that is an emotionally compelling statement. It's rhetorically powerful. It can make you want to back up and, oh, I don't know. And if I back up, I'm going to fall. And the answer, though, like I said, is one of reason and of logic. There's no logical problem there. The reason for evil is free will. The only way for God to have prevented evil would be for him to have not created us with free will. God could not have created a free will creature who could choose anything available and logically possible for him, and that creature not have the ability to sin. Because remember, God cannot do everything. God can only do things that are logically possible and not against his nature. And so a free will creature who can't sin, you've got a contradiction there. And if we don't have free will, well, that would make us robots. There are two groups of people who believe that we're basically robots, that everything is determined. On the Christian side, we have Calvinists. And when I say this, I don't just mean people who hold to a reformed view of salvation or soteriology. I mean people who, like Calvin, believed that God has decreed where the squirrel will hide its nut before it hibernates. That God has decreed where every single grain of sand will be. Most people have actually never read Calvin. And a lot of Calvinists do not actually hold to that view. But some do. And I find it very hard to figure out how on the view where God decrees every single thing that happens, how God is not responsible for evil. It's an important thing to think about. Just to clarify, you can be reformed when it comes to salvation and not hold to that view. There's another group that holds to what we would call hard determinism, that everything is determined. And a lot of times these people are atheists. I've said before that atheists are materialists. They think only material things exist. Well, that means we don't have a mind. We have a brain, but there's no immaterial self. So basically, I'm a meat machine. Everything that controls me is just molecules in motion, atoms and chemicals and electrical impulses. I'm a computer on an atheistic worldview. Well, that means there's no free will. And a lot of times the people who bring up this problem of evil, they believe in determinism, but they haven't figured out that these don't fit together. And so what's interesting to me is if we have no free will, then no one really chose to commit an evil act. So it really doesn't have any meaning. And additionally, the person complaining about evil didn't have a choice in complaining about it either. And these are things you can point out to people. A worldview should fit together cohesively. That doesn't mean you'll have answers for everything, but it does mean there should not be any contradictions. And remember, it's impossible to create a free moral being who can't sin, which is why we're in the state we're in. Now, I have walked you through how to address the problem of evil when someone brings it up to you. But if I were you, I would be waiting for someone to bring up the problem of evil so you can address it. And then turn it around, a 1-2 punch sort of thing. So we're going to look at how to actually use the problem of evil to make inroads into proving that God exists. The exact opposite thing that argument is supposed to do. The atheist's moral outrage when he complains about the evil in the world, it points to his moral knowledge. When you're complaining about evil out there, you're saying some things are right, some things are wrong. Now as Christians, we understand why this is. Romans 3 says that the law is written on our hearts. Even the Gentiles knew right from wrong, and they didn't have the law written out for them. Why? It was on their hearts. We were created with this innate moral knowledge. And this brings us to the moral argument for God's existence. Just like we had the cosmological argument, there's a moral argument. But the first question you can say to someone, by what standard do you say something is evil if there isn't God? Well, look at the options for standards in a minute. You've got 4 of them. And when you analyze them, all 3 of them fall apart, and there's only 1 good one left. So here's the moral argument. If God does not exist, moral values do not exist. However, objective moral values do exist. Therefore, God exists. Now, whenever anyone makes a claim, they have to substantiate it. They have to prove it and give evidence. Claims are not arguments. In the same way that saying, when an atheist says God does not exist, that's a claim. They need to give you evidence how they know that. Well, when we say that objective morals do exist, we need to be prepared to give evidence for that. So, when we say that if God does not exist, moral values do not exist, what we mean is that morality requires a grounding. So, it can't be just based on what I like, which would be relativism, if you remember back to our second week together. Relativism would say that moral claims and truth are relative to the person making it. So, it might be okay for me to lie, but it's wrong for you to lie. And this is the ice cream thing, remember? That there are as many different best flavors of ice creams as there are people who believe it, but that's not how morality works. So, it's not based on me. And the point here is if morality is just up to me, then there's nothing actually out in the world to complain about. It's just in my mind. Something that I remember, it was new to me when I learned it. Immaterial objects can have properties. Actions can have moral properties to them. So the action of murder has the moral property of being wrong. Jesus' death on the cross, well, it has some interesting moral properties, but because of people killing him, that is a wrong action. Because it's God's fulfilling of his perfect plan for salvation, that also has a positive quality to it. But memories, they have immaterial qualities to them too. Memories are not just brain states. Don't buy that lie. So a memory might be a positive one, or it might be a painful one. And so the point here is on relativism, there's nothing actually wrong about murder itself. It's only wrong because I believe it's wrong. That is a key difference. There's nothing actually about the murder that's wrong. So there's nothing to complain about. And morality differs from person to person. So if I say it's up to me, I can't really criticize you if you have a different moral view. So the first potential grounding for morality, relativism. It doesn't work. The second is what we might call a voting or consensus approach. It's popular today to say, well, we take a vote and we determine what's right and wrong. That doesn't work. This is sometimes called social contract theory. Societies make a contract with each other to live a certain way because the majority agrees or it benefits them. Where this comes from is anthropologists who observed that various cultures have different standards. One culture might say marriage is between one man and one woman. Another culture might say marriage is between one man and two women. Well, there's a difference there. So what they say is that morality is relative. This is bad logic. Does everyone see the brown slide here? Brown slide. Same page? Okay, good. It's what you say? It's green. Well, I'm colorblind. That's brown to me. Does this mean color's relative because I see it one way and you see it another? No. And that's the mistake that the anthropologists and others in our society have made. Is just because two people come to different conclusions does not mean that there is not a correct answer. There is. But people can get math problems wrong too. That doesn't mean that math is relative. If I say 2 plus 2 equals 5 and you say 2 plus 2 equals 4, one of us is wrong. It's not, oh, well, we just decide for ourselves. It's not how it works. And morality doesn't work that way either. For argument's sake, let's say we agree that morality is relative. Well, which is what our culture wants to do today. How could we impose our rules on others within society? If we say everyone decides for themselves, we should never ever hear the statement, you're wrong. You shouldn't have done that. You're a bigot. You're hateful. We should never hear that. If everyone gets to decide what's right. So we can't actually live with that standard. What you may notice is that social contract theory is just a bigger group version of relativism. And since relativism doesn't work, social contract theory doesn't work. But it's worse than this. People in our society today, a lot of times who are relativists, like to complain about human rights violations in Africa and other countries, in the Middle East. Look at how they treat women. Well, wait a second. If everyone decides for themselves, maybe that's right for that culture, because the majority agrees. See the problem with that view? Additionally, social contract theory makes Martin Luther King immoral. When the majority agreed that blacks were not equal to whites, he went against that and said, no, equality, let's integrate. Well, that makes him immoral. He went against the consensus at the time. Social contract theory makes Hitler right. I hope you're starting to see this is a really bad theory. But it's popular today because people don't think through their beliefs. They don't analyze them. So morality requires a grounding. It can't be relativism. It can't be social contract theory or a vote or consensus type of thing. A popular grounding for morality today, or proposed grounding, evolution. So survival of the fittest is what guides morality. And somehow, I'm not quite clear on how this works, but over time, just like the stronger supposedly come to the top, moral traits somehow developed and were passed on through our genes, and we become a more moral society. So morality on this view is what helps society flourish. Right off the bat, there's a contradiction. Survival of the fittest and evolution, when we talk about it in any other context, is about the fitness of an individual. Me getting my genes into the next generation. Me surviving as an individual. It's not about what's good for the group. Additionally, this cannot explain noble deeds. It does not explain the soldier who hops on a grenade to save his fellow men. That in no way gets his genes into the next generation. Michael Roos, FSU professor, philosopher, says morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction and has no being beyond this. But I'm pretty sure I don't want to speak for him, but generally people with this view would say that it's morally good for someone to hop on a grenade. But that doesn't help him reproduce, and it definitely doesn't help him survive. So this doesn't make sense either, but it gets worse. If survival of the fittest is what creates our morality, how on earth did we end up with homosexuality? By definition, that does not pass your genes to the next generation. And what's interesting today is a lot of people who hold this view that morality is grounded by evolution, they're also in favor of same-sex marriage and homosexual relationships. Now, I'm not bringing the Bible into this at all at this point. I'm just saying that makes no sense. Why would survival of the fittest create something that will not create people who are fit for procreating? I'm not saying homosexuals shouldn't procreate. I'm saying that they're not attracted to people of the same opposite sex. Just want to clarify that. On this view of natural selection and morality, rape would be a good thing. Now, people will disagree with this, but think logically about it. Rape produces offspring. It gives someone a greater opportunity of passing their genes on. But we know rape, and the people who hold this view of morality, no rape is a horrible thing. So this is another part that does not fit together in their worldview. C.S. Lewis says that selfishness has never been admired, and survival of the fittest promotes selfishness. That doesn't go together either. So somehow, knowing that selfishness is wrong is a moral judgment. So evolution has created us in us the knowledge that selfishness is wrong. But selfishness is how we get our genes into the next generation by natural selection. Another problem. We could keep going, but the last one I'll give you. Survival of the fittest would justify murder and genocide. The strong kill and take from the weak. That is what we see in the animal kingdom. That's supposedly how science would tell us we got here today as humans. But now we want to say that, no, that's immoral. No, but that's still the best way for the fit to survive and thrive. So, relativism does not ground morality. Social contract theory does not ground morality. Evolution cannot ground morality. It's a bad moral theory, and in a week or two, we'll look at why it's a bad scientific theory, too. So that's our first premise, though, we're addressing of the moral argument. If God does not exist, moral values do not exist. Morality needs a grounding. Our second premise, objective moral values do exist. Pretty much everyone has things they believe to be right or wrong. You'll often hear people say, everyone knows that, fill in the blank. Everyone knows that, you know, killing babies is wrong. Or maybe killing toddlers is wrong. We might have to change that a little. Now, on that example, I want to point out something. When I discussed initially what evil acts we were talking about, and I mentioned the destruction of the Canaanites. So here's how this works. The atheist says, God doesn't do anything about the evil in the world. And at the same time, he complains that God ordered the destruction of the Canaanites. You can't have it both ways. The Canaanites, one of their practices religiously was to have this metal god named Molech, and they would put fire under his outstretched large hands, place their babies on it until they burned and died. And so the atheist is complaining that God ordered the destruction of a culture that practiced this. You can't have it both ways. And that is just one of the many things that the Canaanites did. When we say everyone knows that, or when people say that, they're leveraging this concept of moral knowledge that we all have. Now, some of us are a little more in touch with it than others, but we all have it. And from an evolutionary perspective, it makes no sense, as we saw. That's not something that natural selection would give us, because it's not going to help me survive better if I'm putting other people first. Now, you will talk to some people, there is a group, who believes morality does not exist, period. And so, a conversation with this person might go, is rape wrong? Well, it might be right for someone, it's not right for me. Some people will say this. And delicately, but confidently, you need to be able to handle this and make it personal for the person. Not in a mean way, not in an offensive way. Okay, well, what if your wife were raped? Did something wrong actually happen? Now they're in a pickle, especially if their wife's sitting there. That's the question. Is the person really going to say, no, I just don't like it, but nothing actually wrong happened? They might say those words. But inside, they know that's not correct. An argument you can use, my point was, you need to make it personal for people. Because when we say, well, was Hitler wrong for what he did with the Jews? Some people will say no. Some people will say no. So you need to make it personal. What if your child were kidnapped? Did something wrong actually happen? Or is someone just carrying out their evolution? Make it personal. Naturalists, atheists, believe that only material things exist. So, morality can't exist. Morality is immaterial. Here's the question you ask such a person. Can morality exist and not exist at the same time? They're going to say no. Good. What that person just did is use the second law of logic, which says that something cannot be what it is and what it is not at the same time and in the same way. The power can't be on and the power can't be off at the same time. The laws of logic are immaterial. So in trying to say that morality can exist and not exist, the person has proved and used the existence of an immaterial reality, something they're saying doesn't exist. Let's walk through that once more, because this is really important, and people aren't always comfortable with this. Morality is immaterial. Logic is immaterial. Mathematics is immaterial. Now, yes, both of these immaterial objects or things can work with real-world objects. I can add two apples to two apples, and I get four apples. But math itself is not material. It exists whether it's written down, used, thought about, or not. And so when the atheist or naturalist uses logic uses math, he is using something his worldview says does not exist. I hope you get that. That's really important. Now, I've had conversations with people who say, I believe that morality doesn't really exist. It's relative. But I have to live like it's not. Well, that seems similar to me to saying, I believe gravity doesn't exist, but I try not to jump off of buildings that are too high. If you can't live in your worldview, that should be a huge red flag. So, the moral argument. If God does not exist, moral values do not exist. Moral values do exist. And you have to try and show people how that works. So, God exists. This is your second argument for God's existence that we've touched on. And for some people, this is much more compelling than the cosmological argument, the argument that God created everything, or that everything must have a creator, I should say. And briefly, I want to talk about the nature of man, of us, of woman too. Most worldviews see man as basically good. Christianity sees man as basically bad. And yet, I hear a lot of conversations, and it slipped out of my mouth a couple times too. Well, that person's just, he's basically a good person. No, he's not. The danger in saying that we're better than we are is we now diminish the need for God's grace. Additionally, it makes us less likely to need to share the gospel with people because, oh, they're not as bad. The interesting thing with the different worldviews, Christianity is really the only one that says there's guilt. Pantheism, the view that everything is God, well, there's no guilt because you're actually God. You just need to realize it. That's really the view. It does sound silly. Naturalism, there's no guilt because you're just a product of your environment. Christianity, however, there is guilt, and it recognizes we can't do anything about it on our own. But it provides the solution to this guilt, to this sin problem. But it's extremely important to realize that people are not basically good. Our first week together, I shared the example of a school teacher who, when interviewed about her students committing destruction on school campus, said, well, they come from underprivileged homes. And some people have said that society makes people bad. This is part of kind of a naturalistic worldview. Well, let's think through that claim together. People came before society. People are basically good. People make a society, which is bad. Good people make a bad society. How does that work? It doesn't. I hope you've seen over our 5 or 6 weeks now together that while it can seem very compelling, the atheistic point of view has so many holes in it. It does not hold water. It does not stand up to the reason that it holds so highly. So in summary tonight, there's no actual problem of evil, at least not for the Christian and not for God. The problem of evil is one for atheists to answer. What are you actually complaining about? What's the grounding for this moral thing? Is it just that you don't like it happening? Well, why should I care that your preference was violated? It doesn't bother me that you like a different ice cream than I do, and that's the sort of thing we're talking about if morality is just up to us. So the problem of evil is a problem not for the Christian, but for everyone else. There's no logical contradiction in the problem of evil. People have an innate moral knowledge. They know things are right and wrong. You can use this in conversation. Do not feel discouraged if someone will not admit what you're trying to get them to admit. Remember, in a conversation, there are two possible positive outcomes that you may not see. That person will go home and think about what you said. You've put a stone in their shoe. Additionally, most conversations take place with witnesses. So how you comport yourself, how you present yourself as a Christian, will do damage or help your testimony. But even if you don't convince the person you're talking with, Other people are listening to your arguments, to what you say. And so remember that you're not just discussing something with one person. You're making a case probably in front of many people. We learned the moral argument tonight. If God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. However, objective moral values do exist. Therefore, God exists. We walked through how to address each of those points, how to give evidence for them. We also said that morality requires a grounding, and it can't be relativism. It can't be social contract theory, and it can't be evolution. None of them explain morality. God alone is capable of grounding morality. Let's pray.
Some questions that you have that would benefit other people, and we could, if that's up to you.
No, that's not good.
That's not good?
Okay. No, that's good. I'm kidding.
So, you know, we can keep a, you know, a relative cap on it. Let's say for 10 minutes, something like that. But if you have some questions, and we can branch to anything that's been covered, I would suspect.
Yeah.
And that might provide a little interaction. Again, feel free to get up and go. So by all means, just whenever and however you need to go, do that. But if you have a question, just shout it out real loud. And maybe you don't, but I thought I'd open it up. Maybe
I see that hand.
So the question is since homosexuals in biblical days in Leviticus didn't follow God's prohibition about a man being with a man, and what we saw happen was men went on to have relationships with animals and all sorts of relationships. Is that what might happen today?
Would they be okay with that?
Would that be, yeah. I think that is the natural extent. We'll talk about homosexuality in 2 weeks, but as soon as culture has the view that morality is something we define and not describe, well then marriage is anything we define it to be. And there's no principled argument against me marrying my dog, or someone marrying their 13-year-old daughter, anything like that. And so I think what we're going to see within the next few years is group marriage being more popular, polygamy coming back. It kind of already is in some ways. And you're right. If you don't accept an absolute moral authority, then anything goes. And there's no actual standard against it. Does that answer your question?
What was your question? This is in regard to a statement you made a few weeks ago about the passage from Jeremiah that you said, okay, we can't claim that one, but we can't claim the one I'm going to claim. Another one called
yes.
Can I look at it and say, okay, that was addressed to the Israelites saying, go to Babylon, set up shops, and you'll prosper. Can I claim a general, you know, God will provide for me, God does have plans for me. Not claim that specific, but claim that overall principle of that passage in Jeremiah.
The question is with Jeremiah 29:11, can we claim that in a general sense? If you'll remember, I said that verse was not for us. We're not exiles. We're not going to Babylon. We're not Jews. But can we claim that in a general way? I think the things we can take from that do apply to us is that God does have a plan. God ultimately is working everything together for good, conformity to Christ, like we saw tonight. We do know from other verses that God does have a plan for the salvation of those who are saved and for prospering us spiritually. The danger with the Jeremiah 29:11 passage is people use it when I lose my job. Well, God's gonna prosper me. And they don't generally mean it in a spiritual sense. They mean it in I'm going to get a better job. And so that's the danger I was talking against there. I do think that God wants to work things to our good spiritually, in our prosperity spiritually. But does that answer your question?
It does, yes.
Okay, good.
Oftentimes when Brian and I have discussed that verse and others in particular, we both have kind of come to a conclusion where, you know, the conforming to the likeness of his son. So God works together for the good of those who are called according to his purposes. And he's going to conform them into the image of his son, Romans continues. Well, the image of his son is not a pretty picture. And so I think we have to get the rosy Christianity out of our minds that God is going to make everything, you know, suburban American, you know, financially prosperous idea.
Yeah.
God's prospering you may involve severe hardship. And he may use you for the good of other people, like what happened to Joseph ended up being to the good of other people. And same thing with Jesus. So when we are conformed to the likeness of the Son, we have a totally different perspective on what suffering entails.
Definitely. In the back.
Okay. The question is, since it seems like we're going to lose the culture war, if that's what I understood, when do we start preparing for that? When do we talk about what it's going to be like when the name of Jesus is an offense that's punishable? And we're getting there. I think that's why you all are here. That's kind of how I see it. And so we can't change. I do think it's improbable that we will change culture and bring it back to how it used to be. But I think there are things we can do along the way to make the gospel compelling where people are at and to hopefully stave off persecution that would hinder our work of sharing the gospel as long as possible. Our last week together, we're going to talk about some tactics, some ways of talking about homosexuality that will make the conversation go better than it would have if you hadn't used them, most likely. So the goal should be not to fear persecution, except for the extent, my opinion, that it will hinder us sharing the gospel. I do think we need to prepare ourselves mentally and spiritually that our culture is becoming less accepting of us and more hostile. But that simply means we need to up the stakes on what we're willing to do in terms of we shouldn't have the feeling, well, if I share the gospel, I'm going to lose my job, so I shouldn't share the gospel. I don't think the Bible gives you a foundation necessarily to stand on that. What we see instead is the apostles putting their lives on the line, sharing the gospel in prison, going back because they didn't follow the laws of the day. And so I think, to answer your question in summary, it requires a boldness, it requires being winsome in how we talk to people, and knowing some tactics and some information that can help us dispel these bad ideas in culture today. Will we ultimately stem the tide? No, but we can do more good along the way than if we hadn't tried.
I don't mean to keep tagging along, but I had a concept of light and darkness, especially from tonight. The darker our culture gets, you remember Jesus in John 1, he came, he was light, and the darkness couldn't overcome it, but the darkness didn't want anything to do with the light, because why? It exposed their evil deeds. So as our culture gets darker and darker, we either dim with them, or we seem, or maybe possibly, hopefully, become brighter. And if you notice tonight, like I noticed when I pulled out my laptop, it was offensive. It hurt me. It hurt my eyes to see something bright light in this darkness. And I think that is going to be the nature of what it means to be a Christian as our culture dims spiritually into darkness, is we will be a brighter light. In fact, I think you could make a case that Christianity and the gospel spread the most in dim and dark and evil cultures because of persecution and because of the faithful witness of those who are willing to be a light for the gospel.
Definitely.
Are there any examples that anybody can think of where culture as a whole has increased its morality? Or is the example always that it degrades?
Thinking back through history, there have been times, I think of Rome and others, where culture has gotten more and more hedonistic, more and more it's about pleasure, it's degraded more and more, and it ultimately falls.
Right.
And then in the rebirth, maybe things get better, and then they go downhill again.
But at that point, it has to fall. And so the question is, can anybody think of a context where a culture starts to go into that nosedive, and before it completely falls apart, they right the ship? That's up for anybody, right?
Israel happened with the kings.
I gotta go, but I gotta say one thing. This is the kind of culture that Jesus came to, and he shared, they followed him, became obedient disciples, and shared the gospel, and it changed the world.
Yeah.
I gotta go.
Thank you.
And isn't that what revivals are all about? Haven't there been cultural revivals in history?
Kevin, I don't have a good answer to your question. I can't give a historical answer with any confidence, especially recently studying a history of philosophy in the West and the history of the West, and its basic decline. I mean, cultures do that. They tend toward that because man is evil. But I do think, you know, like Barrett said, like Candy's mentioning, we're not without hope. And we have the gospel, and it is the very thing that we need to share. It really ought to, I mean, I know this isn't the answer to your question, but should inspire us to try and make more of an impact in any way we can with whom we can. But I don't have a good answer to your question. Maybe one more question,
yeah.
And we'll depart, if there is one.
Yes, ma'am.
I don't know if you're covering this in the coming weeks, but when you talk about like moral values, especially like abortion and homosexuality, how can you reach a person like without being judgmental? How will you be able to convince a person that their lifestyle is wrong in a loving way?
Okay. The question is how can we convince someone that their lifestyle is wrong in a convincing way? Is that right?
Yeah, in a loving way.
In a loving way. Okay. The first thing I want to point out is that in order to tell someone they're wrong, no matter how you do it, it's going to require a judgment. And you need to be prepared that no matter how nicely you do it, the person will probably say, "You're judging me." In our second week, we talked about how to address that. By them telling you that you shouldn't be judging them, that's a judgment. And you can point that out, you know, in a calm, kind way. And it's that same type of approach that I would want to use with the person. I would want to show them that their view of what's right and wrong probably doesn't fit with actually how they live. And so they want to say that, most likely, morality is up to us to decide. And kind of pulling from tonight a lot, I would want to show them how that view actually doesn't work. And ultimately, in order to get anyone to salvation, we have to do 100% of our part, and the Spirit has to do 100% of His, which He will. And so it's both. But I think that really depends individually. With abortion, there are some very compelling arguments that are not offensive at all. And we'll talk about those, I think, 2 weeks from now. Well, thank you, everyone. It's been good and enjoyable.